Well, it was 65 years ago that the Roswell Daily Record blasted an infamous headline, and I've got a copy of that in my Los Angeles office, claiming local military officials had captured a flying saucer on a nearby ranch. Did it happen? Well, in a moment, we'll talk with a former CIA agent about his thoughts on that and also his life as a CIA agent. Stand by for all of that. He's the author, Chase Brandon, of The Cryptos Conundrum, and he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Chase Brandon, 35-year operations officer in the CIA's clandestine service. He lived undercover for 25 years, retired from covert assignments back in 2006. He still continues to consult with several intelligence community agencies, the Department of Defense, and numerous state and federal law enforcement organizations. In his final assignment, Brandon was a senior staff officer for the director of the CIA, serving as agency spokesperson and the CIA's official liaison to the entertainment industry. Here he is back on Coast to Coast. Chase, how are you?
Hey, good morning, George. How are you?
I'm doing fine. What's your reaction these days when you hear people talk about the CIA, Chase, and they say, oh, this is a covert operation, they're out to do all these things? You were with the CIA for 35 years. You've got a lot of friends there. You're well-respected yourself. What is your reaction when you hear things like that?
Well, look, the CIA is an extraordinary organization, both in terms of the mission given to it by the U.S. government to go out and find the kinds of information, knowledge, secrets that are stolen from foreign governments and foreign transnational groups, so that the CIA analyst and everybody else in the organization can put together a composite every morning of what's going on around the world, so that sense of what's happening can be passed to number one, our number one consumer, the president, in the form of the president's daily brief. Information goes to selected people who are able to have dissemination of our intelligence products, and those are the people in the oversight committees and other members of the federal government, certainly the war planners and war fighters at the Department of State, and absolutely elements of the federal law enforcement community, especially those that deal with terrorism and other kinds of criminal activities directed against the United States in the United States. So the mission of the agency itself is comprehensive and of extraordinary importance. The middle name of the organization, for Pete's sake, is intelligence. And you absolutely must have people who possess intelligence at the individual level in order to go out and collect the information, assess the information, process it, and turn it into something that helps the rest of the U.S. governance structure do what it's supposed to do to safeguard U.S. national security interests, American facilities, and the lives of American citizens. So, by definition, people who gravitate toward wanting to take on a job, a career of that magnitude, pretty motivated, pretty impressive, pretty talented people. And just because you would like to do it, it doesn't mean you can come in, apply, and get a job. You have to be able to pass a rigorous background investigation and all manner of other security validation checks before the agency elects to bring you into a pretty specialized line of work. So, prima facie, you're talking about a really remarkable group of people, and it has always been my most extreme sense of pride and privilege to have been part of that great organization. So when I see newspapers or news programs excoriate, vilify the mission of the organization, accusing it of doing all kinds of conspiratorial, Machiavellian things that are directed against somehow Americans and American interests. And when I see feature films and TV programs and other entertainment industry products that would invariably, as they always did, show CIA in one of two forms, either a bunch of bungling Cluzo cops or outright ugly, venal, corrupt traitors and rogue operatives, as they're always called. I've never liked any of that, because having been given the remarkable opportunity to live my life as an agency officer, I knew the heroism, the dedication, the loyalty, the patriotism, the risks that many of our officers, especially in the clandestine service, take, and the tragedy and the pain of losing even one. But we have on our major big granite wall inside the lobby of the original headquarters building, we have a galaxy of stars chiseled in the wall for people that went out and did their work and paid the ultimate sacrifice, lost their lives. And there is a book on a small pedestal in the center of that wall, and it contains some of the names of all the stars that are up there. The telling tale about the consequence of the work and the organization itself is that most of the names of people who died and whose stars are chiseled in the wall aren't shown in the book. There's just simply a little black star and a black right. line. They remain anonymous even in death. So it's a remarkable place. And I never liked the fact that we were so universally misunderstood and so poorly represented. And I actually had a chance after my 25 years in the clandestine service to do something to help rectify that when I was given an opportunity to be the first ever overt spokesman for the covert side of the agency.
And that must have been a pretty interesting position. We'll talk a little bit about that. Well, at the time that you came in, Chase, of course, the KGB was doing its thing. The Israeli Mossad, which is still in existence, was out there. How would you compare the CIA in terms of being an intelligence gatherer to those kinds of agencies?
It's difficult to make quantitative comparisons to groups and organizations whose methodologies are secret, and our competitors, former KGB, modern-day NVR, the Russians, and Mossad, and the MSS, the Ministry of State Security for China, and all of the other thousands, actually, of intelligence services, like us, when they do their work correctly and effectively, and they have successes, nobody knows about them by virtue of the fact of their success. We always fell into the category that was once described as, CIA is an organization that's known by its failures. Well, look, collecting intelligence and then running presidentially directed and approved covert action programs in the propaganda and misdirection arena abroad, and paramilitary activity on the ground in foreign countries where low-intensity conflict, terrorism, insurgency, and all manner of other international criminal activities are taking place. When we do that sort of thing, it is a big risk versus gain equation, and everything we do is weighed against how badly do we have to acquire this information, how rapidly must we move to gain some insight, collect some new pieces of the puzzle, if you will, that we can put on the agency's metaphorical kitchen table every morning and try to figure out what's going on around the world. How hard do we have to push? How many risks do we have to take, including putting our own people's lives and the lives of people who agree to work with us around the world? How much do we put out on the line there to get back what we're trying to acquire? So risk versus gain. Well, the nature of the business is that the risk versus gain means that oftentimes the risk is really pretty high, and there's a failure in our vernacular called flap. Something doesn't go right. It's a complicated world out there. I firmly believe, based on certainly, if nothing else, my 5 years as a full-time Class A general machinist, which is how I worked my way through college, incidentally, yeah. Undergraduate school at least. When you have complicated machinery making complicated parts and you have complicated structures, by definition, the complexity of the organism will generate its own brand of additional complexity. So we're out there doing massively complex operations, and stuff goes wrong. And when it does, we have that flap, we have that failure, and we get the press for it. And so, absolutely, we are known by our failures. What we don't get credit for, what the American tax-paying public, whose dollars keeps our front door open and our work staff paid, nobody ever knows about the successes. So when you ask, how do I compare CIA to these other organizations, I would say we all do fundamentally the same sorts of things for the same political reasons, because almost everything having to do with any sort of governance centers absolutely around politics. And politics creates at the 60,000-foot level above the ground on which all the rest of us citizens and people daily plod about doing our business. The 60,000-foot level political equities press down and affect all manner of things, social, cultural, ideological issues. They generate a lot of complexity. And under the ground level that most people walk, if you could get down under there and look, you would see that most of the political trees that grow at ground level aren't just individual growths popping up here and there. If you looked under the ground, you would see that all the roots are connected in a tangled Machiavellian conspiratorial way, because that's where the clandestine activities take place. That's where the manipulation and the exploitation and the operations are run to gather the information that no other country wants to share with us. We are always concerned. Every country mostly is concerned about the business of neighboring countries, other countries scattered all over the world. And in that governance structure are a president, a prime minister, a king, a queen, a dictator, a despot. Somebody sits at the top of that food chain. There are all manner of governing offices and bureaucracies, departments underneath them. There's a military. There's a military-industrial complex. These countries have resources. They have issues at home. They have plans and intentions to do something to or with neighboring countries. They have regional hegemony interests to exert their own influence in their own region. There is an endless list of stuff going on in the country. Sometimes stuff going on in other countries has a bearing on our own U.S. national security interests at home and competes with our own global hegemony tendencies and interests around the world. So CIA wants to find out what the who, what, when, where, why, and how of all that is, so we can report it back to our governing structure. Well, every other country is doing the same thing. They're so we have operations people all over the world from all the intelligence services, and they're all rooting around trying to get sources and access to pockets of information, proprietary information, none of which any one government wants to have revealed to any other country or the rest of the world. So you get all that conspiratorial stuff going on, and the whole idea is to find people that are willing to also take a risk for some kind of gain to provide information to us.
Well, let me ask you this, and I want to get into the Kryptos Conundrum, which is a great book. It's fiction, but it's created quite a stir, and we'll talk about that in a second. But, the CIA, Chase, has always been accused of or tied into these various areas, and I want you to react to that, that they were part of the JFK assassination, that the CIA is running drugs, they're making black ops, covert money, using it for all other things, and that they knew about 9/11. I mean, we keep hearing those things as news people and as American citizens all the time. How does a CIA agent react to that?
Well, look, the agency operates on a highly compartmented need-to-know basis. Is there anybody inside working for a blue badge wearing professional staff official of CIA. Is there anybody that knows everything the CIA does? George, frankly, I doubt it, to include the director. I mean, we're the smallest federal agency in the Washington alphabet soup of organizations, but it's still a large enough organization, and it's certainly a complex one, and in spite of its openness, it still is fundamentally at heart a secret organization. Things are firewalled, compartments are blocked off, there are projects that a few people know about, several hundred people might know about. You know, there are things that maybe only a handful of people know about. So having been there as long as I have, and everybody that I know, my colleagues, professional colleagues who've worked there, I would hazard a guess that all of us would say, well, who knows what we don't know? But one thing we do know working there is there is an orderliness to the place. There is a mission commitment. There are absolutely good people who are nothing if not 100% exemplary patriots, dedicated American citizens, CIA professionals.
Sure. And I would say most of them are that
motivated to do the right thing for the right reason.
I would say most of them are probably that way. Dedicated, hardworking Americans.
Yes.
There's no question. But then there is that possibility then that some of these things we hear, maybe, maybe not, but we're not sure. Is that pretty accurate?
It's a world where it's hard to prove, you know, false negatives. It's hard to know what you don't know. We are as we say we are when we're doing our official missions that are authorized by the White House. We report to the executive branch. I will tell you that if you are a clandestine service officer, you stand on one side of a line that says you are honest, you are accountable, you have integrity, you follow rules and regulations, you are a team player, and yet, by nature of the work we do, which is to go abroad, lie and steal for the U.S. government, we lie about who we are, we have covers so that we don't run the risk of being identified while we're overseas by foreign governments who would like to grab hold of us, or international, transnational criminal types, the terrorists, who would literally like to kill us, we have to keep our identities safe. So we lie about who we are, and we steal. We get those pieces of information, those puzzle pieces from around the world that nobody wants to give up willingly. So we have an entirely different doppel shift when we step on the other side of the line and go to work. So that in and of itself is a complex kind of lifestyle and creates its own brand of conundrum. So can there be people that do things they're not supposed to do? Can there be pockets of, you know, some kind of broader, you know, mean-spiritedness in the agency? I don't know that. I mean, I absolutely don't. But how do you definitively rule it out? How do you definitively prove anything anymore? Life's gotten too complicated.
It is way too complicated. Were you with some of your other CIA friends and associates? Did you ever get together for coffee or at lunch and go, what do you think of this one? I mean, did you guys ever talk about things like, you know, 9/11? Was there a conspiracy, or was it indeed just the terrorists that pulled these buildings
down? Yeah, no, absolutely. We totally react to news stories and allegations and charges and everything else. And we do compare notes about what we know to the extent we can without telling even a lifelong, closest professional working colleague who in the process has become a lifelong personal friend at literally a brotherhood, a band of brothers level. We still don't talk among ourselves out of the bounds of the compartmentation into which we have exclusive knowledge for things we do. And
with that,
we might like to share it with a colleague, we don't.
Okay, with that, let's talk about, when we come back, the Kryptos conundrum. It's an incredible story. It's fiction. It has to do with extraterrestrials. And because of that, There's a major story breaking all around the country that included Chase, and we'll get his reaction to it. We'll be back. And our guest, we've got him for 2 hours, Chase Brandon, ex-CIA agent, author of the book, The Cryptos Conundrum. We'll talk about that and some other issues when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Chase Brandon with us, author of The Cryptos Conundrum. Chase, when I say and I call you an ex-CIA agent, is that accurate? I mean, I always thought once you're a CIA agent, you're in. You don't get out.
Yeah, the old adage is, with the Hotel California, you can check out, you just can't leave. There are people that say, you never can leave. No, you absolutely retire. Most of us absolutely come back in one kind of contractor or annuitant form as another, because most people so enjoy what they do, or literally so proud to be part of the organization and committed to the mission, that they keep doing it even after long after they've retired and could go on and do other things. They choose to continue to keep their hand in, their foot in, if you will, because they like the work. George, if we could just go back, I mean, I know it's your program, but you asked me some specific things about, my reaction to charges that the agency would have been involved in 9/11 and the assassination of Kennedy and all the classic things that we conveniently get tagged with by people who like to create good storylines. The notion that CIA would have somehow had any kind of involvement in 9/11 with bringing buildings down, fomenting an act of terrorism in this country, is ludicrous beyond articulation. So I completely, reject that, rule that out. I was still in school when Kennedy was assassinated, and believe me, like everybody else, I heard that the agency was behind that. Never in my time in the organization I see anything or have any reason to add anything to any other than the overt press charges and conspiratorially oriented folks who still maintain that to this day. I will tell you this, having the acquaintance of a very distinguished and now quite senior elderly man who is a physician specialized in emergency room medicine his entire life and is still physician emeritus at a major medical facility somewhere in the States. He was, then a much younger emergency room on-call doctor at Baylor Hospital on the day of the shooting. He and another physician were in the emergency room when the two gurneys were rolled in, one with JFK's body on it and the other with Governor Connally's. And in the triage of the moment, clearly the president was being looked at first. And the one physician was around the front looking down at Kennedy and said, got a wound here in the throat. My friend was standing around behind and said, "Don't bother. The president is dead. Yeah. He has no skull left in the back." And indeed, the Secret Service officer, agent who recently did the book, saying that Jacqueline Kennedy, when she crawled back on the end of the convertible sedan there, was reaching back to pick up her skull cap. So his point, the doctor's point, was this, and it ties into the conspiracy thing about CIA. The doctor's point was, having been always involved in forensics of especially gunshot wounds, he said, no way does a bullet impact the back of the head, pass out, through the front, leave a small round hole in front, and leave a gaping wound in the back. It's absolutely the other way around. So he totally has ruled out, and I've never understood why this man was not interviewed and never appeared on any of the post-shooting incident reports. He said no way in the world was President Kennedy shot from behind. And other people have long since come out with the Zapruder film and all the other sightings of somebody up on the grassy knoll. So if the question to me is, you know, do I believe there's a conspiracy about the assassination of Kennedy? I say there's a very complex story about how that occurred, who may have been involved, what kind of political equities were driving the decision to carry out something as massive as presidential assassination. Do I think my organization was involved in it? No, I absolutely don't. And I can't tell you specifically why I don't. It's a feeling that it didn't have a role because I've been a part of the place. And that's actually going to tie in later when I know you're going to ask me about the box. and I'm going to tell you about my feelings there.
And
what I know about my agency.
But when you say, Chase, that you don't think the agency was behind it, and I can agree with that in some issues, but that doesn't negate the possibility that some people within might have had knowledge, might have participated, might have been part of their own thing, whether you know that or not, and I don't either, but I'm just throwing that out.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if nothing else, in the first segment, I established the fact that it is a complex world, compartmented across the board, but especially within an intelligence organization, also in the military. And how do you know what you don't know? You don't. So does anything fall into the realm of possibility? Yes, absolutely. Yes, or anything can happen, and most of the time, things have happened because there are conspiracies, there are plans and intentions that groups and organizations carry out for all manner of other 60,000 foot and subterranean motivated reasons, and most of us who walk around at ground level aren't aware of any of it.
I have interviewed thousands of people, and my gut tells me that you are an honest person to the day you say it the way you believe it. And if you can't say it, and we're going to get into this classification in a moment, you won't say it. But I do not believe that you are lying about anything, nor would that even enter your mind. That's my gut about you, Chase.
Well, I appreciate your feeling that way, and I applaud your keen judge of character because
it is all right. So let's talk about first of all a little bit about your book, The Kryptos Conundrum, and let me tell you why it has created such an incredible stir around the country, because we have an ex-CIA agent writing a fictional book, and a darn good one, about extraterrestrials and good old Mother Earth and the history of cataclysmic events. And on the face of it, people will say, hey, this is a novel. It could be a movie. He's having fun doing this. But then on the other hand, people will say, wait a minute, he's an ex-CIA agent. He knows something. Given all that, our dear buddy Lee Spiegel, who I just think the world of, he's a good writer, writes for the Huffington Post, wrote an article several days ago, and let me read the headline. Roswell UFO was not of this earth, and there were ET cadavers, ex-CIA agent says.
Yeah.
And so I read into it, and the ex-CIA agent he's writing about is you.
That would be me.
So let's talk a little bit about what you said and what you saw and how this story even came about. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, look, one of the first things to point out, and I'll come back around to this with you. The issue actually is not what was in that box and what I saw. The real issue of consequence, and I want to wind up on it, is what was not in the box. Okay, I'll make that distinction and come back to it. But here's the first thing Yeah, I mean, I don't have a copy of what I said in front of me, but I think one of the first things that Lee said was that I looked in the box and said, oh my God, Roswell really did happen. And I think he credited me with saying that it was not a weather balloon. And
let me read his quote to you, Chase, and you tell me if you think this is accurate. Tell me if this is what you said. He says, and he's quoting you, it was not a damn weather balloon. It was what it was billed when people first reported it. It was a craft that clearly did not come from this planet. It crashed, and I don't doubt for a second that the use of the word remains and cadavers was exactly what people were talking about.
Absolutely. Exactly what people were talking about when they were first interviewed back in July.
47.
It is what the first individual that stumbled across it, the rancher, Mac Brazel, said. I think he contacted this Sheriff Wilcox, who was the first civilian official on the scene. He used the terms remains and cadavers and bodies. And then Major Marcel and other military officers from the Roswell Air Base came and looked and made reports and used the same language. And all the other townspeople that when word of this spread literally like a brush fire, other people all came out and saw and compared notes and talked. And so, for the first 3-4 days, whatever it was, when all that was breaking out there, people were all saying the same thing. And I'll bet you, George, if you had met any of them and spoken with any of them, your assessment of them would have been the same as the one you just articulated about me. That they all seemed like regular people who did not have any kind of agenda and were saying what they believed, what they had seen, and recounting the total veracity of what happened at that particular place and time in history. It was interesting, July of 47 was a big deal. Roswell occurred, but it was also passage of the National Security Act, which turned the theretofore War Department into the Defense Department, took the Army Air Corps and broke it out and created the U.S. Air Force out of it, created the National Security Council, and an organization called CIA. All that, came to passage about 3 weeks after the Roswell event. So all these places were brand new. In my estimation, people back in Washington, military, senior people, top brass people, thought about what had been said and verified by the military service, what was appearing in the newspaper and going around like crazy in the civilian sector, especially out in the in Mexico area. I think people did exactly what they did. They got on planes and flew out to New Mexico and sort of huddled up with everybody and said, we can't go there with this. We have no idea what's at stake by making these revelations about what I, in my heart and soul, clearly believe was the truth. And so began the process of dealing with containment and information management. And how is that done? Well, it's done with propaganda. It's done with the careful constructs. In our modern world, it's called advertising. You want the public to buy a certain kind of product. You package it in a way that they're more apt to lay out their hard-earned dollars for it. And I think there was an effort to hold back on any more revelations until studies were done and assessments taken. My God, what happened here? What does all this mean? And what do we do about it? How do we calculate this into the whole national security complex at a time when the world was not quite into the hysteria of the Cold War that emerged and the threat of global thermonuclear war with the Soviets, but all of that stuff accelerated during the 40s and into the 50s and 60s. Good Lord, I mean, we were doing nothing if not changing at light speed and absolutely heading toward the complexity in which we find ourselves today. It's been a process, a cumulative process over many, many decades. So I already, as I was older, I already had a predisposition wherein I felt like Roswell was what Roswell was originally described as being. It was a site where some kind of craft, not of this planet, not from this world, came down in a smashing heap, and that there were beings, creatures, whatevers on board, and they were seen, they were discovered, and it was all scooped up because that debris field was picked cleaner than a hound's tooth. And I have no idea where all of that went. If it went into crates and went into government warehouse, it's like the closing scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Sure. Yeah. So the Ark was in some box somewhere, and nobody knew about it.
Nobody knew about it, and I absolutely understand how things that get covered up become further covered up through the attrition of there being no continuing focus on them and fewer people that had clearances to know, the need to know, as they die off. You really do lose something through the transition of time and the passage of history, and so I think a lot of the ability to ever go back and find forensic evidence that says with 100% certainty that this happened or that this didn't happen. I think it's really hard to do that now, especially with this one particular event. Well, so, look, I already believed, and moreover, as I had been traveling around the world for the agency doing my work overseas, I had an opportunity to see the majesty, the beauty, the mystery of the world. And some of the things I saw were places like Machu Picchu, Sacsayhuacán, Teotihuacán, Stonehenge. And George, I have to tell you, as a machinist who did very precision cuts on high-tolerance, tight-tolerance aircraft parts, I understand cutting with tools something as hard as a piece of metal, the angularity, the grooving, the boring, flat surfaces.
The exactness.
And the exactness of it, and the complexity to do something of a constructive nature like craftsmanship. Okay, I've been to these places, and I look at stones. Just in the case of Machu Picchu alone, there are stones that were, number one, quarried as near as they, archaeologists and people can determine, from about 75 miles away from the rock spire upon which Machu Picchu sits. 75 miles away, came up a roaring, nonstop waterfall of a river called the Urubamba, and then that stone, which, oh, incidentally, that one stone, the size of a living room in a regular house, was lifted 2,000 feet straight up the side of a vertical rock spire and plopped down on top of Machu Picchu, and the cuts of the stones like those around Sacsayhuacán, the fortress above Cusco, multiple sides, 12 sides to some of these stones, all precision fitted with other humongous stones. And, George, you can't slide a piece of print paper.
No, between something happened. And Chase, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more. I want you to talk specifically about this so-called box that has created this furor about Roswell. We'll get into that. We'll see what you can and cannot say about it. We'll also take some phone calls. We've got Chase Brandon, ex-CIA agent, for one more hour. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.